From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the country is still reeling from mass shootings over the weekend in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio.
I don't know how we deal with evil. I don't have a textbook for dealing with evil other than the Bible. I'm sorry. We're going to go through this.
Will Congress take action this time? We'll ask a member of the Massachusetts delegation. Also today, the history of racism in the presidency.
By the 1950s, it is essentially taboo to be explicitly racist in the Oval Office. But that doesn't change the formulation about a kind of inferiority of different racial groups.
And Boston's One City, One Story invites the city to unite around a single short story, announcing this year's selection.
These two women at the center of the story are approaching each other from different positions, but each trying to use that relationship to cement something about their own identity.
It's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This show originally aired earlier today.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start today with the story that's still reverberating around both the region and the nation. Two mass shootings over the weekend, one in Dayton, Ohio, the other in El Paso, Texas, that have left at least 31 dead. Joining us now on the line is Congressman Jim McGovern. He represents Massachusetts' 2nd District. Representative McGovern, thanks for joining us today.
I'm happy to be with you.
Representative, I think I just want to start by asking you your reactions to these mass shootings this weekend.
Well, look, like everybody else, I mean, I'm horrified. We're living in a country where massacres occur on a regular basis, and it's unacceptable. And quite frankly, it's frustrating that Washington hasn't done anything. And, the House of Representatives, we passed 5 months ago some gun control, gun safety legislation that would have closed loopholes with regard to background checks. I mean, it won't solve everything, but it's a step in the right direction. But we did that 5 months ago. And Mitch McConnell hasn't held a hearing, hasn't set a date for debate, won't bring it up. We ought to demand that he call the Senate back and begin to act on some of the bills that the House has already sent over to the Senate.
So, Congressman, as we talk about El Paso and Dayton, I keep finding myself wanting to make sure to remember and acknowledge this comes just 1 week after yet another mass shooting at a garlic festival in Gilroy, California. As we revisit these bills that you're calling for Congress to do, has something shifted with the level and the frequency of the violence over the last couple of weeks? And what do you say to voters who are fatigued and say, you know, no matter what, nothing's going to be different?
Well, things will be different when voters hold their leaders accountable. I mean, the bottom line is, if you have a member of Congress or a member of the United States Senate who refuses to take action on common sense gun control and gun safety legislation, then you ought not to vote for them again.
What do you consider to be common sense, Congressman? The president had a number of policies he talked about yesterday, like red flag laws.
Common sense, I mean, but the president also said that guns weren't responsible. That's where I disagree with him. The bottom line is, you can make excuses and you can say, well, this is a mental health issue, or this is a violent video games. Well, other countries in the world, have challenges with mental health issues and violent video games, but they don't have the number of gun deaths that we do in this country. They don't have massacres that occur on a regular basis. The fact of the matter is, guns are the problem. We should have done something a long time ago on this. I remember meeting with the parents who lost their children in Sandy Hook. I mean, I thought, in the aftermath of a massacre where little children were murdered, that maybe that would have compel Congress to do something. Congress didn't do anything.
One of the things that's striking, Congressman, is that restrictions on guns are actually, from a polling standpoint, they're widely popular public policy. The NPR poll in July said that 89% of Americans support background checks, and there was a Washington Post poll from 2018 that said 85% across the country support the red flag law. So with it being so popular and with the tragedies you've just mentioned, why is the traction not there?
Well, I think I follow the money. The NRA and the gun lobby have poured countless millions of dollars into campaigns of my colleagues in Congress, and certainly have been very generous financial supporters of this president. And I think that unfortunately too many have been intimidated and have been afraid to stand up to the NRA and to the gun lobby. Meanwhile, we see record numbers of gun-related deaths in this country. We see massacres happen on a regular basis. So, you know, I mean, the question is whether or not people are going to demand, and we'll see. I think the next election will be a telltale on this, whether or not, we really want to do something. We do, and people need to hold their elected officials accountable.
One of the things that I'm hearing you say is that, you know, the voters need to hold elected officials accountable in the next election. That's not until November 2020. And given the number of mass shootings, we've had something like 6 or 7 just since the beginning of August. What does the country do between November 2020 and now, right? Given the rate of shootings that we're seeing, it can't possibly be the case that one just waits until then.
Well, no, I'm not. I don't want people to wait. I want people to take action in the meantime. I mean, if as somebody who believes in the value of protest and dissent, I would urge people to make sure that they're contacting their Congress people and their senators and demanding action. I would do protests. I would do marches. I mean, one of the things that compelled the House of Representatives and the Democratic majority in the House to act was the overwhelming, support for gun control legislation that young people were advocating for all across the country. We had marches on Washington where hundreds of thousands of people came and demanded Congress take action. And I believe that those actions, those acts of protest, those acts of where people demanded change, I think made a difference and compelled the new majority in the House to do something. And we did. I mean, 5 months ago we did something. And again, I think we need to do more than what we did 5 months ago. But it's a start. And I would ask Mitch McConnell to call the Senate back and to take up the legislation that the House sent to them.
We're talking about the 2 mass shootings in Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas, with Representative Jim McGovern. Representative, President Trump, I want to shift gears a little bit. Yesterday, guns were not the only policy proposal he had in the wake of the shootings. Here he is yesterday on the death penalty.
Today, I'm also directing the Department of Justice to propose legislation ensuring that those who commit hate crimes and mass murders face the death penalty, and that this capital punishment be delivered quickly, decisively, and without years of needless delay.
So as you know, Representative, the Justice Department just resumed executions resulting from federal death penalty sentences after more than a 15-year hiatus. Do you agree with the president's language from yesterday?
I don't. I don't believe the death penalty is a deterrent, nor do I believe it's the right thing for us to be pursuing. I think what was notable about the president's presentation yesterday is he tried to detract us from talking about what the real issue is, and that is guns. I mean, he talked about violent video games. He talked about the death penalty. He talked about mental illness. He talked about everything but guns. And that's the problem. In some states in this country, it is easier to buy an assault weapon than it is to register to vote. There's something wrong with that. Unless we are honest with ourselves, and by that I mean unless we admit that guns are the problem here, then, we're going to continue to do nothing, and we're going to continue to see this unacceptable high rate of gun deaths in our country. It is heartbreaking, but it has become commonplace. And that really in and of itself is shocking.
Congressman, let's talk more broadly about the president's remarks from yesterday. A country turns to its president for solace and direction in times of tragedy and grief. Did President Trump give the nation what it needed yesterday in his remarks?
Well, I don't believe so, because I don't think the president has any credibility on this issue. The president talked yesterday about the need to, confront hate and intolerance in this country. Yet I don't know of anybody who has been a bigger, pusher of hate and intolerance than him. I mean, I mean, this is a man who, at a rally, talked about immigrants as people who are invading our country, and when the crowd shouted "shoot them," you know, he laughed. I mean, this is the president of the United States who, you know, who has so demeaned the office and is so, polarized this country. I mean, he needs to look in the mirror. I mean, he is one of the reasons, and clearly based on what we know about the shooter in El Paso, the president is an inspiration for some of this violence that we're seeing. It has to stop, and he needs to set a different tone. So what he said yesterday to me was frustrating because he's the problem.
On the other hand, Congressman, I do feel like I have to point out, Democrats have called on him, hey, unify the country, condemn white supremacy. He did both of those things yesterday. So why is that not a step in the right direction?
Well, because I think what would have been a better step in the right direction is him admitting, you know, that his own behavior, his own rhetoric may have been used or misused in this, you know, to justify some of these hate crimes that we see happening throughout the country. I mean, look, I mean, we know from the FBI that, you know, wherever he does a rally, hate crimes go up in those areas. I mean, there has to be a relationship here. I would have appreciated the president to admit his own involvement in kind of creating a climate of intolerance and hate in this country. And he could have said, I didn't mean to do it, you know, but I understand that, and we all have to be more careful with our words. He didn't say that. I'm glad he condemned white supremacists. But God, I mean, are we at the point where, you know, we've lowered the bar so low that, you know, that if a president says white supremacists are bad, that somehow we think he's, you know, healing the nation or recognizing the problem? You know, he has a responsibility here, and he needs to live up to it.
So beyond the baseline of atonement and apology, I found myself wondering, you know, from your perspective as an elected leader who represents one state but in a body that represents the whole country, what is the rhetoric we need as a country from our national leaders right now? What is the focus of the conversation?
I mean, I think the focus has to be on unity, on respect, respecting the dignity of every single human being who is in this country. I mean, too much of what's coming out of Washington is, you know, is us versus them, whoever them may be. I mean, the president likes to make immigrants the them. But the bottom line is, we need to be talking about how we come together, how we solve problems, but also how we live in a country, you know, that values respect and dignity and love. I don't know what it is, but I mean, you know, there are some people who think that, you know, it's easier to get people to hate than it is to get people to love. I mean, we need to understand that, we need moral leadership out of Washington, one that compels us to do better. But one that is not afraid to use the word love in our conversation.
So to that point, and I appreciate that. I really, really, actually do appreciate hearing rhetoric about love from a national leader. You know, the president himself also said yesterday, "Open wounds can't heal if we are divided." Congress itself is so divided. How does Congress begin to model what you're talking about and find a way to move forward together?
Well, I think that what has to happen is that, Congress is 435 members of the House and 100 members of the Senate. I mean, it's not like it's a bunch of different, you know, people who are, you know, are part of one body. But, you know, we need to try to find the areas that we agree on, and where we disagree, try not to be as disagreeable, or as polarizing. I mean, look, you don't have to agree on everything to agree on something. I would like to think that in the aftermath of all this gun violence in this country, that there's something we could agree on at a minimum, you know, is the modest step of strengthening universal background checks.
Congress. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I mean,
no, go ahead. Finish up.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think we could come to an agreement on that. I mean, if we could do that and just get something passed, maybe that might lead to more agreements on how we can combat this this terrible scourge that's plaguing our country. So, I mean, I look. I mean, it's But also, too, I think, you know, the American people have to also not reward bad behavior. And so when you have politicians that get up and who, you know, deliberately try to divide the country, deliberately try to polarize our nation, that they don't get rewarded. Because, you know, a country divided is a country that, you know, is in deep trouble.
That's Congressman Jim McGovern. He represents Massachusetts 2nd District. Congressman McGovern, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Oh, as always, it's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Hey, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let's talk about racism and the presidency. Recently released tapes of a 1971 phone conversation between then-California governor and future president Ronald Reagan and then-President Richard Nixon reveal a disturbing exchange referencing African political leaders. Since it's archival audio, it's a little hard to hear, but let's listen, and a warning that this clip contains offensive language.
Last night, I tell you, to watch that thing on television as I did.
Yeah.
To see those monkeys from those African countries. Damn them, they're still uncomfortable wearing shoes.
Well, and then the tail wags the dog there, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The tail wags the dog.
You may not have been able to hear everything in that clip, and frankly, I'm not willing to repeat it, but I will tell you that the language was unambiguously racist about African leaders, and if you want the transcript, you can find it on our site. So this tape, along with numerous controversial comments by President Trump, has gotten us thinking about the history of racism and our country's presidency specifically. So joining us to talk about that today are two historians. The first is Heather Cox Richardson. She's a history professor at Boston College and author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Thanks for joining us again today, Heather.
It's always a pleasure.
Also joining us via Skype is Leah Wright-Rigger. She's a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Leah, welcome to Radio Boston.
All right. Always a pleasure.
So, Leah, let me start with you. Give us some historical context. How has racism permeated the presidency over time?
So I think the broader question is, when has racism not permeated the presidency over time? When we think about the moments of the founding of this country, racism, questions of exclusion, questions of racial difference and racial hierarchy in the treatment of various populations within the United States are central. There's no way that you can ignore it. I mean, if we think about forced migration of slaves, if we even think about something like indentured servitude, if we think about the treatment of indigenous populations, all of that has been central to the presidency since the moment the presidency is actually established within the United States. So it's not actually hard to trace a line through this long historical record of the ways in which racism has been central to various presidential administrations. What's far more difficult is to trace when racism has not been central to the executive office, to the federal administrations, and to presidential politics.
Heather Cox Richardson, one, do you agree with that? And two, if so, what has allowed that level of racism to persist in the nation's highest office?
Well, I agree with Leah, who, by the way, wrote an absolutely fabulous book that I think you mentioned briefly, but anybody interested should check it out, on The Loneliness of the Black Republican. But I agree with Leah that there is a long history of racism in this country that has always permeated the White House and Congress and all that. But I think that we have these moments of heightened weaponizing of racism at times when the people in power feel like they're losing out, like that there's a chance they might lose power. So you see it really dramatically with Andrew Jackson, for example. Andrew Johnson, after the Civil War, when he's faced with the idea of African-American voting, goes absolutely ballistic. We have a moment very much like the present. And you have it really mounting again after, as Dr. Rigger has noted, after the Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s and 1960s, when white Americans start to think, white men especially start to think that they're on the ropes and that they have to fight back. And it's possible then for politicians to weaponize racism and say to white voters, if you don't turn against the black people or the people of color in your midst, because after World War II, this also happens really dramatically with the Hispanic population, you are somehow going to be left out and America is no longer going to be yours. So it's a constant, but there are these heightened moments when people in power think they're going to lose out and they turn racism into a very overt weapon as opposed to the constant that it always is.
Leah Wright-Rigger, are there other heightened moments that you would add to the timeline that Heather just gave us?
Well, I think one of the, you know, one of the most central, one of the most central points or moments, actually, there's a really wonderful article written by an emerging scholar, Dove Grossgrill Weinrib, in The Atlantic today, comes in this mid-1960s period in Kevin Phillips. We see in the emergence of Kevin Phillips, the emerging Republican majority, which comes out in 69, reissued in 1970, where it is explicitly about exploiting, interracial and ethnic differences and resentments as a political strategy. So how can we weaponize this? To Heather's point, how can we weaponize this? How can we take advantage of this? What's really remarkable, though, is that, you know, if you look at the archives, that strategy actually falls flat on its face in 1970 and again in 1974. It's really not until 1984, again, on through this really contemporary period that we begin to see it in heightened moments. The only other point that I would bring up is that in a moment in the aftermath of something like Barack Obama's historic win in 2008, which we can, you know, note as this moment of significant progress, which people erroneously label as a post-racial moment, it's not. What we do see is another heightened moment that is 100% built on backlash politics that takes advantage of racial divisions and resentments and ethnic resentments and really cultivates us, cultivates that and helps us get to where we are in this contemporary moment.
Heather, you were talking to our producers earlier today, and there was a moment in the 1960s, I think at a Republican National Convention, that you thought was quite striking.
Yes, and I want Leah to talk about this because it's in her her book about the Black Republicans. And one of the things that's very important to a lot of people in America right now, and that you hear again and again and again, is that the Republican Party under Abraham Lincoln originally was the one that advocated for rights for African Americans. They weren't so keen on rights for Chinese Americans or Indigenous Americans and Mexican Americans, but they did advocate for rights for African Americans. And so you often hear pundits saying, well, you know, the Republicans are the only party that's good on race, and it was the Democrats who really backed slavery, all of which is true in the 19th century. But there's a really dramatic moment where that shift is very visible, and Leah talks about it in her her book about the Black Republican, and it's the 1964 Republican National Convention, and Jackie Robinson and the African Americans who were there. And Leah, I was sort of hoping I could set you up to tell that amazing story.
Excellent. Leah, over to you.
Sure. And Heather, you're quite kind. Thank you so much for that alley-oop. I think one of the really striking things about 1964 is that for African-Americans, for Black people who attend the Republican National Convention that year, they compare it to Nazi Germany. I mean, they are involved in fistfights. They are called racial slurs. One delegate has his suit set on fire by a Goldwater supporter. And essentially, you know, they talk a lot about how they are being forced out of the party because there is a real schism happening and a real shift happening in the priorities of what the party, what the priority is focused on. And it's not simply, I mean, you know, to Heather's point, this is the year 1964. Some Republicans are instrumental in the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But then the party goes ahead and nominates the senator who has essentially voted, I mean, who has voted against the most comprehensive civil rights act that the nation has ever seen, but also really begins to accept an ideology that, you know, ultimately has them ousting on the state and local level Black delegates and African-American delegates, but also going to extremes like violence at rallies and, as I mentioned before, setting someone's suit on fire.
And in that year in 64, with the nomination of Goldwater, Goldwater actually runs on a platform that calls civil rights legislation unconstitutional, says it shouldn't happen. And in that election, he wins his home state of Arizona and also five deep southern states. That's the moment when southern Democrats, like Strom Thurmond, publicly switch to become Republicans. And it's after that that Nixon in 68, who's got his own issues trying to put together a coalition, deliberately adopts the Southern strategy, which says we're not going to push desegregation and we're going to start to other people of color so that we can hold together a coalition of white voters on the idea of law and order, with the idea that people who are not white voters are not really good Americans and who are not on the side of law and order. So you have this really dramatic turn in 64 that has snowballed to the present moment, where that idea of being a white man is central to American identity and nothing else is. And that, I think really shows up with that attack on the Black people who are at the Republican National Convention in 64.
So we're talking about racism in the presidency with two historians, Leah Wright Rigueur and Heather Cox Richardson. And I want to fast forward in time for a minute. I mean, when somebody sets you on fire, it is hard to mistake their intention. One of the things that we've been hearing, especially from callers, as we've been struggling with questions of race and racism on this show in the last couple months, is this idea of, do we agree on what it is? So back when President Trump first tweeted last month that four congresswomen of color should go back where they came from, quote unquote, we spoke with Michael Curry, the former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. He's also a member of the National NAACP board. He pointed out that we aren't on the same page about what racism is today. I want you to hear a clip from that.
We got to get to a common definition of what racism is, because it's insulting when folks can say something's not racist, but they don't understand that when you say to any person, particularly a person of color, an African American, go back to the country you came from, that's generations of being told to go back to Africa.
So how did we get from the naked racism of setting someone on fire at a convention to this kind of frustration and confusion about, or maybe not, depending on who you are, about what racism is today? Do you understand my question? And I open this to either of you for an answer.
Well, so one quick thing. I think one of the interesting observations I had while I was kind of researching this period, 1964, and talking to delegates who attended the convention of various races, was how people remembered it in their memory. And when I spoke to Black delegates, Black attendees, Black protesters across the ideological spectrum, all of them remembered it as a violent, kind of significant, transformative, racialized, racist moment. And the evidence backed that up. But when I would talk to white people who attended, almost none of them had memories of this kind of violence. And so they would chalk it up to things like, well, you know, we needed a new direction. Goldwater was for local control and states' rights. It wasn't about race. And so there's this transformation that's also happening amongst white Americans, in this case, white Americans who attend, the 64 convention, where explicitly racist and racialized events and incidents over time become interpreted and read as non-racist, right, neutral images based on objective criteria like economic policy and disagreement. So clearly the historical record says otherwise, but there is a way in which things are imagining. I think that's an important part of thinking about the role of, say, individuals, thinking about the role of the presidency and the president, and what in institutions in transforming racist and racialized language into the present day moment.
Heather, I have questions, but let me first just invite you to respond, react, or add to that.
Well, I think Leah's absolutely right. I mean, and I would add to that that by taking sort of a rhetorical change, where instead of, as Lee Atwater said, an advisor to both Nixon and Reagan said, instead of talking using the N-word, you start to talk about busing and taxes and things that seem to be systemic. What it does is it opened up a window for white Americans to be able to say, well, I'm not racist, you know, and this is such a trope, but I'm going to say it. I have a black friend or whatever. They read their personal beliefs into society at large without recognizing that this country, since the beginning, has had a systematic problem with race. It has affected everything from the economy, religion, society, politics, everything. So you get people saying, well, I'm perfectly fine with somebody of a different racial background, without recognizing that every step of our system has been set up to establish the same kind of hierarchy, not only between African Americans and white Americans, but also Hispanic Americans, Indigenous Americans, women. You know, we have a hierarchy, and we have always had a hierarchy, and there are times when we must grapple with that and with luck reduce it back to the point where we can have a democracy again, and we're in that kind of a moment now.
So I want to bring us to this moment now, and I apologize to the two of you and to our listeners for some of what I'm about to say, but you know, I was struck in listening to the 71 tapes of Ronald Reagan with some of the language we've heard from President Trump. Here are a couple of his comments, and I'm just going to read them out, from 2017 and 18, where he was talking about African and Afro-Caribbean countries. He said, quote, "Why are we having all these people from blank hole countries come here?" quote. He's also reported to have said that Nigerian immigrants would never, quote, "go back to their huts," end quote. And, quote, "Haitians all have AIDS. Why do we need more Haitians? Take them out," end quote. Those are explicit comments. And, you know, Heather's just talking about people who might support a particular party or a particular platform or any particular politician being able to separate themselves from words or ideologies. But how does one separate where we are as a country from that kind of language from the highest office in the land? Leah, let me put that one on you.
Oh, that's a big question. So, you know, I think one of the things that has become apparent, and in fact was apparent, didn't just become apparent under Trump, this predates Trump, but that we are in the middle of a white nationalist resurgence and white nationalist violent resurgence. And there is a lot of work going on in studies in this. Scholars have been doing a lot of work. I just saw a new report from Brookings, the Brookings Institute, for example, around this. But what is important to keep in mind is that we have a president who is both part of that larger legacy of racism in the Oval Office, who is also part of this backlash to the 8 years of the Obama administration and significant change in this country, but then who also is now not simply winking and nodding at the fringes, but also providing an avenue for rationalizing it or apologizing for it and telling people that their racialized impulses are not wrong and that they shouldn't feel sorry for it. So absolving them of accountability.
Let me turn to Heather just quickly there for a minute, Leah. Heather Cox Richardson, this idea of a backlash from President Obama, do you agree that is that the moment we're in?
Yeah, I think so. But I also want to add something here that I think is so important to talk about and it doesn't get the attention it should. And that is that this nation was founded on a rejection of the idea that there should be hierarchies in society. Now, of course, there were caveats to that. The founders held enslaved people, and they certainly thought women weren't even people. So there are caveats to it, but it was formed in the Enlightenment idea that we should not have hierarchies. And right now, as Leah said, we are fighting, at least I, anyway, am fighting against the idea that we should, in fact, have a world that is based on hierarchies of color or of wealth or of culture, that in fact the way the world works best is that everybody should have an equal opportunity to contribute to society. And it bothers me when we talk about simply framing things around the idea of white nationalism. Yes, we have those people. Right now they are dominant. That's not what America
can be. America has always been its best when we welcome immigrants, when we welcome people of color, when we look and see what women have to contribute, when we try and produce something new from this country. And I would love us to celebrate that more and say, no, my world is not a white male world. My world is a multicultural, multicolored world, and that's what makes me comfortable, and that's when America is at its best.
So, Leah Wright-Rigueur, in the last 30 seconds, building on Heather's vision for the conversation we should be having right now, what else needs to be in that conversation, just very briefly?
I think one of the central components of the conversation has to be, one, understanding how people are complicit in, you know, in the proliferation and the continuance of racism and racist policies and racist ideals. And namely, I think, you know, most people, if you ask them, will say, no, I'm not okay with racism. I, you know, abhor racism. But what is it that people or individuals are doing that allows them to turn a blind eye to racism? So are you denouncing racism? Are you denouncing racist systems and institutions? Are you denouncing racist policies? Are you saying, okay, racism is fine as long as I get my economic incentives in my pocket? These are some of the things that people have to do to, in terms of accountability, self-awareness, self-reflection, and then taking action on it as a means of being anti-racist and getting us back to democratic ideals.
That's Leah Wright-Rigueur. She's a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. She's joined us via Skype. Leah, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Heather Cox Richardson, a history professor at Boston College and author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Heather, thanks so much again.
It's always a pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The One City, One Story initiative is Boston's version of an all-city read, done in the lead-up to the Boston Book Festival in October. Each year, the city publishes one short story and distributes it for free as a way to unite the city around that piece of work. Past selections have included works by Tom Perata, Richard Rousseau, and Kelly Link. And the Boston Book Festival's executive director, Nora Peel, is with me in studio. She's going to announce this year's selection. Hello, Nora.
Hi, this is so exciting.
So do some announcing.
Okay, well, so this year's One City, One Story is Yvonne by Sierra Birch.
Yvonne by Sierra Birch. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so it's a really lovely multi-generational story about a birth grandmother getting to know her granddaughter for the first time. And at the center of the story is this absent figure of the mother, who the daughter, Celeste, never knew. And so she's trying to understand her own identity by getting to know her birth grandmother and also to understand, by extension, her mother, who she never knew. And this is all complicated by the sort of complicated relationship that Yvonne had with her daughter, which, of course, Celeste wasn't informed about, but is starting to understand as she gets to know her grandmother as well. And it's just a really beautifully written story. Everybody who's read it has responded very passionately and emotionally to it, both to the content of the story and to the maturity and the beauty of the writing.
Yeah, I had a chance to read it, and it really is a beautiful story. Mm-hmm. Before we go a little further there, you know, last year there were accusations of plagiarism made against the selection of the short story for One City, One Story. What did you do differently this year in the wake of that?
You know, our processes have always been pretty rigorous. We do vet all of the stories. We ask that the authors be previously published. We try to do a little bit of research, especially once an author is on our sort of short list of stories to consider. Last year's situation was very particular. I wouldn't expect it to be repeated, and I feel very confident and comfortable in moving forward with Sierra's story and really excited about relaunching the program this year.
Well, let's bring Sierra in now. Sierra, you are a writer and MFA student. You're studying creative writing at Emerson College. And this is kind of a big deal, so congratulations.
Thank you so much.
How excited are you?
I'm so excited.
So past choices include Tom Perata, Richard Rousseau, Kelly Link. These are big authors, and your name is kind of in that mix now. What does that mean to you as an artist?
It means so much to be part of this sort of literary canon that the Boston Book Festival is building, especially still being in school and only in my – I'm going into my third year in my MFA program. So it means a ton.
Yeah, I want our readers to be able to enjoy some of the work. So I'm going to have you read a little bit from Yvonne. The story is about a queer woman of color, Celeste, who was adopted. We know a little bit more from Nora. Let's have you read just a selection from the piece.
Sure, of course. When she was with Yvonne, Celeste was every version of herself she'd ever been. She was introverted, passive-aggressive teenage Celeste, who brought up her adoption in every interaction with her parents and couldn't get through an entire meal without asking why they'd chosen her. Rebellious college freshman Celeste, who took 18 shots in a row to celebrate her 18th birthday, drunk dialed her parents because she had no ex to call, and ended up in the hospital. Middle-aged lesbian Celeste, who was failing at juggling her children's dance practices and football tryouts and worrying about maintaining some spark in her marriage big enough to keep Zara from getting bored with her. Celeste tried to cram every identity into a 2-hour visit once a month to show Yvonne who she'd been and who she was, and ended up losing herself.
So Celeste is a complete human being. Even in the short number of pages that we have, she's a complete character. So what did you draw from to inform such a whole and complex woman?
I get so much of sort of my character inspiration from my family, especially. We're all very close. And so some of their little like quirks or things that they say, I really draw from them. And just from everyone around me, that people are such people, like they're so interesting and you don't really notice unless you're paying attention. And so I just drew on that, the people that I see around me, the people that I know, and sort of she came into my mind fully formed as a person. So,
and you know, you're a very young woman, and Yvonne herself, the grandmother, is a cranky piece of work. And her voice also seems so authentic. Again, as a young woman, how did you write this authentic voice of this older adult?
So she's sort of pretty much not quite a replica, but very much similar to my grandmother, LaVon, who passed away a few years ago. And so whenever I was writing Yvonne, I just had my grandmother's voice in my head, and she sort of speaks or spoke exactly like that.
So my first thought when I read the story was just the concept of intersectionality. There are so many aspects of identity at play in this story and of different kinds of life experiences. There's an intergenerational dimension. There's a race dimension. There's family unit, sexual identity, parenting, drug addiction. Did you set out to sort of tell an every person, every woman, every man story with this?
I didn't. So for all of my stories, my characters are just sort of the main people that I'm focusing on. When I'm writing, I don't usually think about the outside world as much as it doesn't influence me. So I didn't set out to write that sort of story, but I'm glad that it has that sort of appeal just because I set out to write my characters as humanly as possible, and that we can relate to everyone in some way, in some intrinsic human way, I think. And so if it appeals to people, I hope it's because they recognize something of themselves or empathize a little bit more, which they might not have before.
Nora, the ultimate goal around One City, One Story is to start a conversation and engage the entire city
around
one piece of literature. Why is this the conversation Bostonians should be having this year, the conversation that this story invites?
Well, I think it does, you know, regardless of where you are yourself, it does, as Sierra mentioned, it's a type of story that really does encourage empathy and that encourages looking at the people in our lives, the people we encounter, and thinking about that fully formed story that might be informing their actions, that might be prompting their behavior. I think that that's something that is lacking right now, and that certainly well-written fiction can prompt us to nurture that kind of empathy that can be very difficult to find at times like these. And especially with a program like this, with One City, One Story, where we bring together Bostonians from all different backgrounds, people who maybe studied literature in college, maybe people who haven't picked up a short story since they had to in high school, bring them all together in the same room at the Boston Book Festival or at other opportunities for discussion to talk about their response to the story and to really listen and engage with other people's responses as well. I think this story in particular encourages that kind of dialogue and listening to others.
Sierra, we're having this conversation today in the middle of a very challenging time. We've just been talking just earlier this hour about the mass shootings in Dayton and El Paso. Nora says that this book brings forward the opportunity to develop and share empathy. How does your art, how does literature give us that opportunity to bridge difference and find empathy for each other?
Yeah, of course. So there's a quote, and I can't remember who it's by. It's by Dr. Bishop, and it says that literature is sort of a window and a mirror so that we see ourselves, but we also see other people that we wouldn't get the chance to see or to know. And I think that's the point of literature. It inspires empathy and with other situations that we wouldn't have a chance to perhaps experience in our own lives with other people that we perhaps wouldn't encounter because they lived before we were born or on the other side of the world. And it just gives a chance to sort of bridge such a gap that there is in the world because you read about people and you come to understand them and to love them and to care about them, even if they aren't like you in any way.
I want to end today by acknowledging the passing of Toni Morrison. She was 88 years old and died after a brief illness in New York. Morrison was a Pulitzer Prize winning and a Nobel Prize winning author, most known for her novels, books like The Bluest Eye and Beloved. She was also an editor. She championed African Americans in literature. She was praised by NPR's Karen Bates as an author whose, quote, soaring novels were rooted in Black lives, end quote. Sierra, you're a young author of color. You tweeted about this a lot today. What does the loss of Toni Morrison mean to you as a young writer?
Sure. It means so much. It's sort of hard to put it into words, particularly because it's so fresh and because she meant so much. But she opened so many doors and inspired so many of us, not just writers in general, but of course, young Black writers of color, and because she told like ancestral stories and stories of identity and of our lives and helped people deal with generational traumas that perhaps they hadn't been aware of and helped them try to break those things. But she first and foremost portrayed Black people as human, which some people don't realize. And so that is, she just did so much for so many people and opened so many doorways and inspired me especially. And I'm incredibly grateful to her and hope that just her ancestral sort of spirit guides me throughout my career and throughout my life.
There is a great interview from 1998 where Morrison reflects on finding her voice as a Black writer and placing the lives of African Americans at the heart of her stories. Let's listen.
And the people who helped me most arrive at that kind of language were African writers. Chinua Achebe, Bessie Head, those writers who could assume the centrality of their race because they were Africans. And they didn't explain anything to white people. Those questions were incomprehensible to them, those questions that I would have as a minority living in an all-white country.
So I just would love to hear, Sierra, how you react to that.
Yeah, so I was actually TAing this summer, and I was working with a student, and she was writing her personal statement on what it means to be African-American and how it's such a confusing sort of identity because you're not African. And many people, and sometimes yourself, don't see yourself as fully American. And so you're sort of in the middle of what is this culture that I embody and who am I if I don't sort of know my ancestral past and I'm not, and I don't fully fit into this country and this country's culture. So for African writers to be able to embody that themselves fully without sort of explaining anything or feeling the need to explain anything to anyone, that is definitely a powerful thing. Mm-hmm. And it's something that myself, I'm still dealing with, just that being in the middle of those dual identities and what that means as one sort of identity in itself.
Nora, you saw Toni Morrison speak at Harvard a couple of years ago. What will this loss mean to the Boston literary community?
Well, yeah, I was at the Norton lectures that she delivered in 2016, and, you know, especially in retrospect, but it was one of those moments where even in that moment, I think everybody in that room recognized that this was a gift, that this was something that was not going to be replicated again, to be in the presence of somebody who has advanced in so many different ways the conversations that we are having about identity, about race, about history, and the way that we tell that story. It's a monumental loss, of course. But for me, as a festival organizer, I'm honestly most grateful not only to the incredible body of work that she leaves behind, but to the fact that she fostered. And it's, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that she really did pave the way for this whole generation of Black writers, especially Black women writers, who we continue to celebrate and feature at festivals like ours. And hopefully her legacy will live on for so long.
Okay, so very quickly, before we run out of time, where can people read Yvonne, the One City, One Story selection?
We'll be starting to distribute it in early September. It'll be available on our website and in hard copy all over the city of Boston.
Nora Peel is executive director of the Boston Book Festival, of which WBUR is a media sponsor. Thanks for joining us, Nora.
Thanks for having us.
And Sierra Birch is an author whose story Yvonne was selected for the Boston Book Festival's annual short story publication, One City, One Story. Thanks for being here, Sierra.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations again.
Thank you.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.